Coming up on Money Bites by Smart Money People.
So these people have backstories that look nothing like, you know, a typical kind of middle-aged banker's backstory.
It's asking me to check my balance, so I'm standing here on one leg.
But fintech has made an impact on the world before, and it's doing the same today, just at a much faster pace.
Bricks and mortar seems to be a barrier to entry, introducing a new era of firms willing and able to challenge the status quo.
So what is fintech?
Welcome to Money Bites by Smart Money People.
Hello and welcome to Money Bites by Smart Money People. Coming up on today's show, we're asking, will fintech change the world?
Well, today we'll be looking across the fintech landscape to investigate the impact being had on finance at large. We'll be talking to Daniel Simon. Daniel will be talking to us about the industry, its future, and the release of his new book, Money Hackers. But first, we've prepared a quick history of fintech, from its humble beginnings to a global phenomenon.
So what is fintech? Fintech is the application of technology designed to make financial services better. It may sound like a frighteningly modern phenomenon built around mobile phone apps or slick metal cards, but fintech has made an impact on the world before, and it's doing the same today, just at a much faster pace.
Let's start in the 1960s.
You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off.
If you've been asked to point out a technological breakthrough during this time, you wouldn't be blamed for pointing to the moon landing.
ABC News presents the flight of Apollo 11, beginning 30 hours of continuous coverage of the lunar landing.
But did you know that same decade saw the invention of ATMs and the establishment of the NASDAQ, the world's first electronic stock market?
Now, just as Neil Armstrong took one small step for man and one giant leap for mankind in 1969, perhaps the same could be said for the evolution of online banking. In 1983, in our very own backyard, the Nottingham Building Society, former guests of the Money Bites podcast, were the first financial institution in the UK to offer access to online banking.
We're the Nottingham. And we put you first. Call now or visit thenottingham.com.
However, it wasn't until the late 90s that the internet started to break into the masses, with usage increasing tenfold between 1995 and 2000. In 1999, Egg tapped into this trend, becoming the first internet-only bank in the UK. Meaning its customers no longer needed to wait in queues or worry about branch closing times.
At the same time, computer chips became exponentially more powerful, smaller, and affordable, helping to power much of today's fintech innovations. Mobiles have become as capable as desktop computers. Snake moved from 2D to 3D. And Apples and BlackBerry suddenly entered the wish lists of consumers across the globe. By 2008, 17% of us owned a smartphone, increasing to more than 80% today.
Rapid smartphone adoption and high-speed internet access meant financial firms were no longer tied to the high street. Bricks and mortar ceased to be a barrier to entry, introducing a new era of firms willing and able to challenge the status quo. And challenge the status quo is what consumers wanted. The Great Recession leaving many disenfranchised with the behemoths of Canary Wharf. Unhindered by legacy systems and slow-moving corporate structures, firms such as Starling and Monzo quickly tapped into the minds of consumers with app-only models that focused on the customer experience, an approach that nodded to the successes of Silicon Valley.
Today, fintech is more than just a slick app, with technologies such as blockchain and open banking disrupting the way firms share information, make decisions, and develop products.
Fintech is also gaining an increasingly global dimension, with some of the most notable investment and innovation coming from mainland Europe and China.
It's fair to say that fintech is increasingly changing how we interact with our finances, changing the ways that we pay, access our money, and even invest. And what's more, it's not over yet. Greater banking competition, more innovation, and rising consumer expectations will add even more fuel to the fintech fire.
Good afternoon, Cash Home. speaking. How can I help?
Hello. I'm currently standing on one of your cash machines, and I'm very confused. It's asking me to check my balance. I'm standing here on one foot, looking right like a right buck. I've never had great hand-eye coordination, but I don't understand the correlation between me being a balanced man and being able to withdraw cash.
What do you mean?
It's asking me to check my balance, so I'm standing here on one leg, seeing if my hand-eye coordination will keep me stood like a pole, and I'm getting very out of breath, and I don't understand why this is necessary.
I just caught on to what you were saying.
Well, can you please explain the correlation? It's very confusing.
It's asking you to check the balance of your account.
What are you... I'm going to have to explain, I'm afraid.
So the balance of your account.
Oh, not my balance.
No, the balance of your account, your balance.
I must look like a right buck. Oh, God, how embarrassing. Wait till I tell Meredith later. Oh, bloody hell. Well, thank you very much.
No problem.
Oh, look at that, £400. Okay, well, thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
So, now we're all filled in on the fintech phenomenon. It's time to hear from Daniel Simon. Daniel is a fintech industry insider as well as CEO of global communications firm Vested. Mike called up Daniel earlier this week for a chat about the future of fintech and his new book, Money Hackers, how a group of misfits took on Wall Street and changed finance forever. Take it away, Mike.
Time to fire up the hot seat as Mike welcomes another guest in to grill the big cheese.
We're joined today by Daniel Simon. Daniel is CEO at Vested Communications, a financial communications agency that has worked with some of the biggest financial firms on the planet. Daniel joins us ahead of the release of his new book, Money Hackers, how a group of misfits took on Wall Street and changed finance forever. Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us in your own words a bit more about Money Hackers and what the story you've written is all about?
So the Money Hackers is a look back over the last 10 years since the financial crisis at the characters and the technologies that have basically transformed the way that we interact with our money. 2008 was a pivotal year in people's relationship with money. There was this little thing called the financial crisis, and there was a massive explosion with the traditional banking industry. And at the same time, some incredible technologies that we take for granted today, like social media, like mobile tech, kind of really came into their own. And those two things together, the vacuum that was created by the financial crisis and this incredible explosion of processing power and technology, created basically the system of the way that we interact with money today. And this is a story about how that came about. And we also look a little bit ahead at what's the future for people's money.
And there's definitely been a lot of change in the world of finance, Daniel. So like every time we talk to a fintech, they always kind of use words like democratization, right? They always come up with these big words. Is what we're seeing really a seismic shift, or is it actually just more of the same but badged up in new and fancy words?
That's a false dichotomy, right? The hard choice to make. Some of what's going on is definitely bundling up, and I wouldn't just say in fancy words, but in better technology, better interface, mm-hmm. right? So, you used to have to go to a bank and you have to kind of try and pick your way through a host of different things. Today, the technology has made it so that you interface with things in a much more simple way. So on the one hand, it is just a repackaging. But then, to the point about democratization, packaging matters. You don't know how your computer works, but but Windows and other operating systems make it really easy for you. And so now you have a computer in your life. You don't know how the electricity works, but a little interface called a switch has kind of made it so you can make light come on and off, right, where you are. So in many ways, it is just the packaging. It is just a repositioning and an interface issue. But you shouldn't underestimate the transformative power of interfaces, right? When computers went from DOS-based, command-based computers to basically something that anyone can point and click, Like, it became transformative for everyone when coding the internet became something from a small band of people were doing to basically like Wix or the way that you Squarespace or the way that you build websites today. Now, and then with social media, which is self-publishing, essentially, everyone became a publisher, right? Mm-hmm. So interface kind of matters.
Are the kind of big banks, are they worried or are they still kind of in the discovery phase, right? So monitoring what's out there, seeing what they like, figuring out these guys aren't going to last for much longer. How are they going to cope with the disruption that's coming about?
Yeah, to date, it's been much more in the second category, right? So, and I mean, partly, by the way, this conversation changes, depends on whether you're talking about Europe, UK, or whether you're talking about the US. Despite mm-hmm. my British accent, I'm actually an American, and I spend most of my time in the States, and a lot of the book has been focused on some of the transformation that's happened in the US, where the landscape sort of much more favors the large financial institutions. So the kind of stuff that you've seen over here with Revolut, Monzo, and N26 has taken much more time to take hold in the States. Same things like peer-to-peer payments and contactless, which are really just in their infancy in the States and are much more established here. But broadly, you're just taking, you know, the whole world at a glance. They've been relatively circumspect, either building out their own kind of offerings, so like robo-advisors, like you've got Nutmeg here in the UK, there's Wealthfront and Betterment in the US. Most banks now have some kind of a robo offering. They didn't go out and rush to buy the fintechs. I think they are still waiting to sort of see kind of how this all plays out. They're not panicked. And many of the platforms that people use today, like Venmo in the States, don't fundamentally disrupt their core underlying banking relationship. They're connecting it to their underlying bank. So it's not been massively threatening. Fintech hasn't been enormously threatening from a market share perspective to the traditional banks. From an ideas perspective, from a kind of a conceptual perspective, it's fundamentally changed the way that we do everything and the way that banks are doing everything. So,
and I think you're right to talk about ideas. There's certainly been some massively disruptive fintechs starting to take hold, but still relatively small. Where are we from a landscape shifting perspective? Are we still going to be talking about disruption and fintech in 10 years' time? Is there a lot more to come? Or actually, have the ideas that have been launched, are they all in the market now? What we're waiting to see is the growth and the growth in market share that's going to follow them.
That's a really good question. I think the answer is we've still got more to see. And the next wave is going to come from the big tech companies, not the small fintech. So I think what fintech did is it woke up the sleeping giants of technology, Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, to the potential of financial services as an area that's really ripe for disruption. And that's why even since I put the book to bed, you know, since I sent it off to the publishers, almost immediately we got Google launching checking accounts, Facebook obviously trying to get into cryptocurrency with their own, you know, with Libra. You know, they're looking at somewhere like China, where you could use a platform like WeChat to do essentially the stuff that Uber does or Venmo does, or a checking account or a social media function all inside one app. And I think if you think about the amount that you're in your Gmail account or you're on Google or the amount that you're inside Amazon or on Facebook or Instagram, you know, they capture a huge amount of your attention every day. And so the idea that they could offer sort of finance-like services inside that workflow is very natural. So I think that, and of course, they've got the real market share and the real attention, the real audience to truly challenge the banks in the way that the small fintechs, I don't think, have got that kind of an opportunity.
The title of your book, Daniel, it talks about a group of misfits and how they took on Wall Street and changed finance forever. So who are these misfits? Why are they misfits and what did they do to change finance?
I'm glad you asked that question, because that's really the heart of the book. It is not, for anyone who's listening and thinking about buying it, I want to reassure them it is not a book about payment gateways and the mechanics of peer-to-peer lending.
Daniel, that's all our listeners switching off now. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. It's not about that. It's that stuff in there, but what leads that stuff is the fascinating individuals who brought all that stuff to life. So, you know, one thing that I discovered when going out to kind of talk to, you know, when you start thinking about lending, when you start thinking about peer-to-peer payments, how we split money between each other, or send money to one another, and you're thinking about remittances, how we send money abroad, or savings, or investments, you know, and you look around the world and say, well, there's so many different providers, and I can do so much of it on my phone. The next question is, well, who are the people who made these things possible? And what we discovered when we went out and started having conversations with these founders, these innovators, these CEOs, is they look nothing like the typical people that you expect from finance. They just are not your grandparents, you know, financial advisor or banker. There's a lot of them are women, a lot of them are people of color, a lot of them are technologists, a lot of them are people who have had completely different careers from finance. So, you know, Renaud Laplanche, who started Lending Club in the States, well, first off, he likes to say, you know, he was an outsider in two ways. He was a lawyer turned technologist, and secondly, he was French. So when he started getting very high credit card bills, he found that fundamentally unfair, and that prompted him to look at the world differently. Someone like Ishmael Ahmed, who founded World Remit here in the UK, in London, you know, he was a refugee from Somalia who studied at the University of London, became the head of remittances for the UN, uncovered this scandal inside the UN, got fired unfairly, and sued the UN and won, and then used that money to start World Remit. So these people have backstories that look nothing like, you know, a typical kind of middle-aged banker's backstory. Steve Street, who created Green Dot in the US, which is the largest bank serving the kind of underbanked and underserved populace, he was out of the music industry. So you've got a bunch of people who are truly misfits. They don't really fit. Even the ones who kind of were insiders were always outsiders. Blythe Masters, who spent most of her career at J.P. Morgan, never really quite fit the mold, partly because she was a woman. And you see that come up time and time again. It's like traditional finance doesn't serve all people. And the new class of people who are the new class of innovators, these money hackers, you know, tend to look more like the people that we want finance to serve.
One of the interesting things behind the book, apart from profiling it and getting to understand some of the kind of key players behind, I guess, this revolution and this wave of disruption, you talk about fintech actually transforming money itself. How do you think it's done this? And can you share some examples from the book?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, look, it hasn't fundamentally transformed the nature of currency. If you look at something like what Facebook is from, a big Libra, or now with central banks looking at digital currencies, you know, there is that potential. And blockchain in particular, which sort of begins in 2008, as I mentioned, 2008 is that critical, pivotal year. That's when the Satoshi Nakamoto white paper gets published about Bitcoin. Obviously, blockchain and cryptocurrencies that are built on it does have a potential to fundamentally change the nature of money. I think most of the people that we profile have fundamentally changed the way that we interact with money, which is to say, who writes a check anymore? Quite often, what's happened, I think you'll agree, is that the amount of payment experiences that you have, the number of transaction experiences that you have as a consumer, have actually gone down. Because if you think about something like an Uber, right? If you remember what, I mean, in the States where I'm from, you know, we used to jump in a yellow cab. It was only 5 years ago. You have to wave your hands around, get in a yellow cab, and then you'd inevitably have to fight with them because even though they had a credit card machine in the back of the cab, the cabbies were really mad with you if you couldn't pay them in cash. So you'd end up having this really hard friction point around a transaction. One of the most basic, so particularly for New Yorkers like me, one of our favorite things when Uber came along was no conversation about cash, no conversation about transactions. Mm. So in some cases, your experience with money is just so much more seamless. Mm. And in some cases, it just doesn't exist anymore. So it's less about the actual nature of money. That has not changed. But the way that we interact with it has fundamentally changed. And so to your earlier point about democratization, you know, the promise of a better user experience is that we don't have to educate people about how money works to get them invested in the stock market, to get them saving, right? So in the US, we've got platforms like Acorn, like Stash, and like Digit that will algorithmically use AI to kind of figure out when's a good time to take money out of your account and do that sort of smart saving for you and either invest it or keep it in cash. Now, that's really important because we've been trying to teach people cerebrally, we've been trying to teach people the importance of saving for, you know, 100 plus years. We've been saying it's really important to save. So instead of trying to beat people over the head about the importance of compounding interest and the importance of saving, you know, if they can take an app like a Stash or a Digit or an Acorns and it can painlessly remove money when it's available, when there's a surplus, it knows without you having to think about it how to take that money and where to optimize it, where to put it to give you the biggest return. You know, that's very transformative.
Hmm. So you talk about fintech and its role making things seamless, right? And we talked about kind of packaging up things at the start and how people kind of package up financial products. There's a growing debate here in the UK around retail finance, right? And how actually removing some of that friction from the process of effectively taking out a product is potentially not always going to be a great idea, right? So do you think the rise of fintech and money hackers is going to ultimately be good for everybody, or actually are there going to be some kind of casualties along the way?
Well, I think it's a canard, as you would say, to this idea about credit and availability of credit. And, you know, I've heard this argument that, like, you know, are we making it too easy for people to borrow money when they can't afford it? And it's a very big conversation because the reality is that for the affluent among us, those who kind of urban, live in New York, live in London, kind of have a decent income, you know, we use credit in one particular way, which is to say we use it to finance things that we couldn't just afford with cash, like widescreen TVs or cars or houses. That's fundamentally not how the vast majority of people in this country, in the UK and in the States, are using credit today. We have a larger structural problem, which is that we are moving to a gig economy, we're moving to a shift work economy, and people can't get regular income. They've got massive income volatility. And that's especially acute a problem where I'm from in the States, because people don't have the social safety net that they have here in the UK. So, you know, imagine all of the problems you see with the shift in gig economy in the UK, minus a national healthcare system, an unemployment benefit, and you end up with a problem where people really are exposed to fixed costs and volatile income. And in those places, they're using credit to smooth the lumps of income volatility. And they should be, because the alternative is bankruptcy. We need a way to provision credit to them in a responsible way. Technology is the answer, actually. It's not the problem, it's the solution. Part of the problem that those people have getting credit is they may earn lumpy incomes, and it's hard. The traditional banking system doesn't know what to do with someone with lumpy incomes. Mm. It knows what to do with you if you have a nice checkbook, you get pay stub every month, you've got your mortgage. That's how the traditional financial system was created. The problem is those people don't need the credit. Those of us who still have jobs that have regular incomes, we don't need the credit. Mm. And the financial system, as it was created 100 years ago, doesn't know how to deal with people who don't look like, you know, Ford employees in 1960 or GM employees in 1960. Mm. Technology can solve that problem. All you're trying to do with a credit decision is this person in a position to potentially pay back this loan, right? And if you take a look at the whole, so for example, just really simply in the States, The way that we've always looked at credit is people's creditworthiness, is their ability to borrow money and pay it back. Mm. When I moved to the States from the UK when I was in my early 20s, I didn't have any credit. And the irony was, I couldn't get any credit because I had no history of borrowing money and paying it back. Technology, they can look at my whole life. It can look at my rent statement. It can look at what I buy. It can look at, you know, whether I put money into my savings or not. And it can make a much more holistic evaluation of my responsibility, of my credit worthiness, right? And so the answer isn't we need less technology. The answer is we need more technology to be able to keep up with the way that the world has moved in terms of the way that we're currently paying people and remunerating people. And so actually, I think there's a crisis. I mentioned before, a savings crisis. There's an employment crisis, even though we've got historically low unemployment numbers, it's masking the reality of what that employment looks like. We have a crisis. You talked about what is the future of fintech. The next phase for fintech is to actually try and help mitigate the results of that problem.
Well, that's a fascinating thought to end on. Thank you for joining us. Can you tell our listeners when and how they'll be able to get hold of Money Hackers?
Yes, you can go on Amazon right now. And you can pre-order it. It will be available on April 14th. So if you just search Money Hackers in Amazon, it's being published by HarperCollins, and it's available for pre-order right now on Amazon.
And that's all the time we have for this week's Money Bites. Thanks to Daniel Simon for joining us, and please do remember to review, subscribe, and why not visit us at Smart Money People. Goodbye.